This chapter is safety and liveness. It is a little bit about more liveness properties and general fault tolerance. The centerpiece of this chapter is about is about deadlock understanding. So let's just repeat a little bit our definitions of safety properties and liveness properties. We had this in the beginning of the lecture. Safety property is always true. Something that you can guarantee throughout the lifetime of your program. We had a number of these examples before. Mutual exclusion has to be always upheld in your programs, regardless where in your programs are, from the very beginning to the very end. You will always have mutual exclusion for critical sections. Good safety property. Then we have a bunch of liveness properties, namely things will eventually happen. Let me look at this in a little bit more detail. This includes things like your requests will eventually get somewhere, will eventually work. And this refers very quickly to concepts of fairness. Fairness sounds like a philosophical dimension, and it is defined a little bit more technically, and there are terms in computer science around fairness which we need to understand, which we need to know, which is weak, strong, linear, and first in, first out. Okay, let's have a closer look what that means. Weak fairness means that if I stay on at the door and I'm not moving away, I will eventually be served. So that means weak fairness. Give me my camera. Weak fairness means that if I constantly put up a request, this is always requesting, if this happens eventually, then I will eventually get this granted. Okay, so if I stay there, I'm not looking away, I'm not moving away, I'm enqueuing a task in applying for a certain entry, and I'm not withdrawing this call ever, and I will be eventually served, that's called weak fairness. Strong fairness is a little different. Strong fairness means that if I continuously request a resource, but I do something else in the meantime. So can I have the resource now? Okay, I come back later. Can I have the resource now? I come back later. Even in that situation where I do something else in my own time and then come back to this request a little later, even then I will be served. That's called strong fairness. So somebody has to take note that this task has been asking in the past, in individual requests, and eventually this task will be gaining access to a resource. That's strong fairness. Can be pretty complicated to realize, as you can imagine. Then we have probably the most common form of fairness, which is called linear waiting. And linear waiting is something that you will also get guaranteed in most concurrent programming language. Those other ones, weak fairness, yes. Strong fairness, hard to do. Linear waiting, yes, is something you can do. What does that mean? Linear waiting means that you will get access to a resource before everybody else gained access to this resource more than once. So nobody else gains access. So let me be more precise. Nobody else gained access more than once before you gain access. Okay? That means I'm not quite sure about the order. There's a whole bunch of people applying for a certain resource, and I'm not quite sure who was first here, but I know that nobody will gain access to the resource twice before I will get my turn. Okay? That's called linear waiting, and this is the common form in concurrent systems. Why? sounds weird and complicated. Why are we defining something like that? Any idea? Okay, let's get to the next one. Maybe it becomes clearer then. To create a round robin system? No, not really. It deals well with non-determinism. That's a very good comment. What form of non-determinism? Let's have a look at the next point first. We had first in, first out as another possibility for fairness. So now we assume everybody queues up nicely on arrival in a first in, first out queue, and we are processing everybody exactly in the order in which they arrived. Sounds easy, right? And if you can do that, of course you do that. But in practical terms, first in may be something which is very hard to determine in a concurrent system. Why? Yeah, Isabel already noted exactly put the finger on the right spot. It can be very hard to determine who was first. Why is that hard? Now, who was first? What communication media, what delays, what message passing delays, what clocks do you assume for that? Assume that everybody comes with their own wristwatch when they come to your shop, and those wristwatches are not synchronized. Neither are they with computers in real life. So every computer has the idea that they're submitting their assignment on a certain time, which is what your local clock says. Now, the server may have a different idea of that. And what the clients among themselves consider first in, first out may look very different from what the server sees at this point. So a fair definition of who was actually first is hard to say. And how do you count this? Is this the time when you actually sent a message, when you received a message? What if you have concurrent receiving daemons, as you have on your computer, that you can actually receive packages in parallel over multiple network lines? Do you have an absolute time when this actually happened? Maybe, maybe not. So first can be very hard. And to circumvent this whole problem, we are usually using linear weighting, where we say that we can easily detect that I assigned a resource twice, but I cannot necessarily easily detect who was actually first. So this is harder to do in real life. What the diamond and the square symbol means? The diamond symbol means something happens eventually. So I have no idea when. At some time in the future, this predicate will become true. So, like, my program will eventually terminate. This would be denoted by this diamond symbol. And the square symbol means it holds always true. Right? So that means if I apply from here on always, then it will eventually be granted. The other way around, if I apply eventually, and this is always true, so many times eventually, then I can eventually also grant access to the whole thing. Okay, those are classical symbols in real-time logic. If you have the pleasure of verifying systems and working in real-time logic, it's a tough field to work in. Welcome everybody. If you would like to verify your systems in the time domain, then you will be very quickly gaining familiarity with eventual and always symbols. Okay. Just for the context of this course, take my explanation for it. Don't fuss too much about the logic implications for the whole thing. Cool. That should be what I wanted to amend on the liveness properties. Now to the big topic. Safety properties. Classical safety properties, probably they're all categorized in three major sections. Mutual exclusion. Been there, done that. I think you all know what mutual exclusion is by now. Okay, don't have to do any of that anymore. And another safety property is absence of deadlocks. This is what we are going to do right now. Deadlocks are usually indicated by something gets stuck, freezes up, you don't know what happens. It's often completely indistinguishable from a technical perspective, from dying silently, nothing happens anymore, some other freezing conditions. Not all of them are necessary deadlocks, but deadlocks will classically result in your system freezing up. And of course, other safety properties, which are more about capacity, safety properties about my memory is not going to run out. Important safety property for slightly more high integrity systems is, for example, no memory leaks. Your system is not supposed to creep into less and less memory available over the runtime of its life. Otherwise, your flight controller in your next carrier plane may be able to fly for about 6 hours. After 7 hours, the memory slowly runs out. Of course, this is not what you can possibly deal with. So you need safety properties which will guarantee you a responsiveness and capacities of all of your resources at any given time. Segmentation fault. Actually, deadlocks are usually not resulting in segmentation faults. Why? Ah, memory overflows. Yeah. Well, often not even really that, because stack areas are getting into each other's feet and communication is starting to get scrambled. It can have even uglier results than that. But, I mean, admittedly, a segmentation fault in mid-air is ugly enough. You're saying it can get even more ugly than that. So, deadlocks. We need to address a few things. Can we predict and find them? Can we resolve them? Or are there possibilities how we can program in a way that deadlocks cannot happen or will not happen? Anybody is willing to give you a guarantee your system is deadlock free? Just do it that way. Nothing can ever happen. That would be nice. Let's see whether we can get to anything like that. And for that, let's have a look at deadlocks first. We have seen deadlocks already in the lecture. This is the most cartoonish example of a deadlock. The probably simple most possibility for a deadlocking system. Here illustrated by use of semaphores. You can, of course, do this with other synchronization mechanisms. What is happening? We are waiting for two semaphores. Semaphore 1 here, semaphore 2 there. And we have another process. Also waiting for two semaphores, but it does it in the reverse order. So the second process waits for semaphore 2 first and then waits for semaphore 1. And you have seen this classically can lead to deadlock situations. This can work, what you see here on the screen. So assuming that process 1 will gain access to the CPU core first before process 2 and has enough oomph to go through the whole process without process 2 even blinking or even gaining access to the CPU to start with, then this whole thing just runs through. done, and then this one runs through, done. So it can work, but you see the danger. I hope everybody right now sees what the naughty case is. And that is process 1 has access to the first semaphore, and process 2 gains access to the second semaphore, and now they're staring each other down. Process 1 is looking at semaphore 2, which is held here, and process 2 is looking at semaphore 1, which is already held here. So they're staring at each other in the main street, and nobody is moving anymore. Classical deadlock. Da-da-da-da-da. Good. Can we do this for more than two processes? Let me do the next cartoonish example. Three processes. How do we construct a deadlock with three? Okay, so we have three processes now, and I have three resources, and I'm making them wait for semaphore 1, semaphore 2, semaphore 2, semaphore 3, semaphore 3, semaphore 1. If that reminds you of dining philosophers, it is exactly that. You're doing reservation of these individual semaphores, and you do two neighboring ones, and unfortunately the last one takes the third one first and then the first one. And same thing, this will potentially again lead to the same deadlock situation. You should all see the potential deadlock. Are you? So we could all have this statement, this statement, this statement. I'm grabbing semaphore 1, this one is grabbing semaphore 2, this one is grabbing semaphore 3, and we're done. Everybody's stuck. Nothing is visible anymore. Everybody's happily blocked. Your CPU usage is actually dropping. There is no flooring of CPU cores, nothing is happening, everybody is just waiting, and your system is frozen. Okay, so let's categorize what can we extract from these examples to identify what is actually a deadlock, when can a deadlock occur. So, number of things which need to be true before we can have a deadlock. First one is, you need to have mutual exclusion. If I'm not dependent on being the only one in a certain area, if resources can be just used all concurrently and simultaneously, we wouldn't ever have a deadlock situation. Agreed? Okay. So you need to have some form of mutual exclusion to produce a deadlock. Then the second one is what is called hold and wait. That means I'm allowing processes to hold some resources and apply for other resources later on. Holding something and waiting for other resources consecutively. This also has to be true in order to produce a deadlock situation. Next one is there is no shotgun available to kick anybody out. So instead of staring each other down on the main street, also one of them could just take the shotgun out and kick the other one out of the resource. Or the operating system could do that. If I have that power, that I withdraw resources from somebody else, I also can avoid deadlocks, because I can emphasize some priorities or kick somebody else out who would be entangling me in a deadlock chain. But it's ugly. Preemption of random resources. If somebody is already holding access to a printer or network and network interface, and then the operating system can say, this printer is needed somewhere else. I take it away from you in the middle of your printing operation. everybody is confused, the printer is confused, you are confused, the operating system has to reset half of the interface again. Very complicated operation. These kind of shotgun operations are definitely not liked. So that's not a good way of introducing that. So usually you do have no preemption for resources. And the last one is the most interesting one. The last one is called circular wait. And that means we have a ring of processes. And in that ring of processes, everybody waits for the next one in that ring. And they're circular connected so that we can have this chain where everybody is looking at the task ahead of itself. And this task is looking at the task ahead of itself, etc., etc. And eventually it comes around into a ring so that this is going to be closed and you cannot resolve it anymore. Circular wait. All right. So if all of that is true, we do have mutual exclusion, we have hold and wait, we don't want to have preemption shooting anybody out, and we have circular waiting, is our system deadlocked? Good question? Bad question? Dumb question? If all four of these conditions are holding true, we have all four of them holding true, is our system deadlocked? Is that all we have to check? Maybe one of the processes could just give up. Yep. Maybe there are other resources given away at the moment to processes which are not part of that chain. Maybe other processes are giving some printers back. You may have a circular wait at the moment among these five processes here, but there are a few other processes which are not part of your chain. And they are also holding printers. If these other processes are giving those printers back, the situation can relax again and everything can run smoothly again. So in summary, what that means is the system may be deadlocked. If all of that is be true, but you don't have a guarantee that you are in a deadlock situation at this point. To actually find a deadlock is a little bit more complicated. But these four conditions are nevertheless very useful because we know if one of them is not holding true, no deadlock. Okay? So we just have to kill one of them to make our system completely safe. And that's the value of these four deadlock conditions. Not that you can just look at them and see that, ah, oh, there's a deadlock, because you can't. But the other way around is true. If one of them is not holding true, you are guaranteed to not have a deadlock in your system. Okay? That's cool. What are the general strategies to handle deadlocks now that we know that? First one, most common one, ignorance. I don't know. I don't know whether the animal is sleeping or dead, hovering over the reset button. I think I kill it. Just power cycle the whole thing. Just press reset now. I don't know. So probably one of the most popular way of handling deadlocks. Other possibility, deadlock detection and recovery. You can actually find the deadlock and then recover your system in a clever way so that it becomes operational again. Sounds complicated, and it is. Let's have a look at that a little later. Then deadlock avoidance. Deadlock avoidance means every time I'm about to hand over resources to somebody, I check whether is that dangerous? Could that lead to a circular wait? could that lead to a deadlock situation? And if so, I'm hesitant to do so. Let's try something else first. Maybe that's not the best assignment of resources at this time. I'm trying to avoid it. I'm trying to get around it. I do this at runtime, which may be still fairly CPU intensive, that I need to check my system at runtime, whether there is a potential for a deadlock to happen. If there is a potential in this direction for a deadlock, I'm not going down that path. I'm trying another path first. Okay. And the last one is the one which you want. Deadlock prevention. The system prevents deadlocks by its very structure. So you can do what you want. You cannot produce a deadlock. And you don't have to check at runtime because you already know at compile time that this system is deadlock free by its very design, by its very structure. This is called deadlock prevention. Prevention means there is no chance that there could actually be anything happening. Avoidance means there is a chance, but I have mechanisms to wiggle around it, to avoid it when I'm actually getting close to it. Okay. So, any question for these different conditions? Or rather for these different strategies? You seem to be fairly okay with that. So let's start by the most beautiful option, deadlock prevention. Can we actually break deadlocks for good? Break mutual exclusion. Can we break mutual exclusion? How would we break mutual exclusion? So one possibility is you look really, really hard whether you need mutual exclusion for a specific environment. What are other possibilities? I could replicate the resource. So mutual exclusion you always need if you have limited resources and you need to use that by more clients than you have resources for. So a simple answer would be replicate your resources so that you always have enough resources and then you don't need mutual exclusion because you can give each resource to a specific client from the get-go. Well, this may work sometimes. Probably not the universally possible case. Breaking hold and wait. Interesting. Breaking hold and wait. What does that mean? I only allow my processes to apply for its resources in one go and then hold your peace forever. So I can do this in one go, then release everything. If I'm not going through in one go, I'm trying to get all the resources I need for this operation, I'm not getting all of them, then I release the ones which are gained and start from scratch again. I'm not doing hold and wait. And I can structurally enforce that. I can prevent all processes from waiting for something which I cannot access at the moment while holding something else. So every time I apply for a lock, I check and the lock is turned down, the lock is currently blocked. Is this process looking for this lock at the moment already holding other locks? If so, take all of them away. Okay, so I can break, hold and wait. That takes quite intense operations on the language side or on the operating system side to do that. And of course, I can introduce preemption. We already discussed that. Introducing preemption is bad because it doesn't really generalize to all kinds of environments. A lot of resources cannot really be preempted without breaking stuff. What? You have access to this robot arm at the moment, to this mobile machine, to this flying robot at the moment, and I just take access away from you because somebody else needs it. The state of this physical system may not be recoverable at all, and everybody is ending up in a complete state of confusion and everything crashes. So preemption in a general way is hard. Preemption in specific cases, of course, always possible, but as a general strategy, this is hard. So, yeah, we're discussing a number of different what would be more efficient. Breaking, let's get through the all possibilities first. Breaking circular weights. Can I break circular weights? How do I do that? Simple strategy, and this is actually implemented in some operating systems. If you, for example, look in the Linux kernel itself, this is what the Linux kernel enforces. You have a global order on all resources which you have, and you are never allowed to apply for a resource which has a lower order number than the highest resource which you are currently holding. You can just prevent this from an operating system interface perspective, and you will be automatically turned down and not blocked, but just taken everything away if you apply for resources in the wrong order. You always have to apply for resources exactly in the same order, and everybody knows what this order is. Now, this is hard to do in a distributed system. This is hard to do in a physically concurrent system, where individual CPUs, individual laptops may not agree or not easily agree on what is my global order of resources. So I don't know in which order they will be ordered worldwide. That's not going to happen. So this is more of a local strategy, but good enough for a local compiler, for a local operating system, to break circular weights. And the majority of you have actually used just that for your dining philosopher's problem. You notice that the dining philosopher's problem arose because one of the philosophers is taking the last fork and then the first fork. And you just turn that around. If you turn that around, it's gone. Because then every philosopher is always applying for the fork with a lower ID first and then the higher ID. And I don't have any potential for deadlock anymore. I have a complete deadlock prevention strategy implemented in that system. Da-da-da-da-da. Okay. So, yeah, Felix comments that a lot of people have done also other strategies. Okay, fair enough, could be true. I've seen some still doing just that, and from a more educated perspective now, this is probably what most of you will do in the future. If you see something similar to a dining philosopher's problem anymore, you first look, because everything else is more painful, taking forks away, not allowing multiple forks to be held. Well, okay, that's still a possibility. That means every philosopher who is holding one fork and not instantly getting access to the second one gives the first one away again. That works as well, but can lead to a life lock. This one will not lead to a life lock. Will keep it completely responsive and also break deadlock situations. Okay? So, any further questions on that? Oh, or added an extra fork. Break mutual exclusion by making it a little bit more redundant, and I'm not running out of resources, also breaking the deadlock situation. Cool. Very nice. So, if there are no further questions, I would like to briefly introduce resource allocation graphs now. Resource allocation graphs is a nice graphical depiction of resource allocation and can give you easy ways to detect whether there is a potential for a deadlock situation or there is actually a deadlock situation in your system. So you can look at the logic definitions here, what a resource allocation graph is. So basically you have vertices, those are these knobs here, or you have edges, which are all of these links, and then you have resources. And the knobs are usually representing active entities, those are your processes. The resources are entities which you want to acquire. And these little slots here mean that for these resources, you have four instances available. And the solid arrow from the resource to the active process means this process is currently holding one instance of this resource. The solid arrow in the opposite direction means that this process is currently requesting one instance of this resource. And the dashed line means that it will request this in future, which is often referred to as it claims. So it doesn't request it right now, but it will claim this in the future. And that knowledge is very useful for deadlock analysis as well, that you already have the full idea which task will potentially in the future claim a specific resource. This can also be done by your compiler, because your compiler can syntactically just accumulate all the excess requests to resources which are just existent in your task. And so you can assume that they can potentially happen. Without solving the halting problem, you still know that this could happen, and this could be already valuable enough to do your deadlock analysis. Obviously, you cannot guarantee this will happen, but you can guarantee it could happen. So, how does a deadlock look by using resource allocation graphs? Like that. Simple most form of a deadlock. Is actually a deadlock. We have two processes. This one is currently requesting resource one. This one is holding resource one. This one is requesting resource two, and this one is holding one instance of resource two. As we only have one instance per resource available, this is actually a deadlock situation. Right? And we will be using those graphical forms now to understand and analyze different forms of different forms of deadlocks. Is this a deadlock situation? I have three processes. These two are requesting and holding. This one is holding. Is this a deadlock situation? And now argue technically, what can you tell me why this is not a deadlock situation? Because this one has two instances of this resource? No, that's not a technical reason. Because nothing prevents P3 from completing. Yes, so this one is currently holding this instance and will probably eventually be satisfied and happy to give this resource back. The moment that this one is giving resource 3 back, this one can acquire resource 3, which means this one has now all resources, has one of them, and can complete its job, can terminate. That means it will give back all of these resources, and process 1 can also acquire this resource. So I have a path forward, which allows me to resolve the situation on the screen. So this is not a deadlock, but instead of just arguing of there's a path forward, how I can resolve that, I could also argue there is no circular dependency on the screen here. Right? You do not have a chain on the screen which says one task is waiting for the next task, waiting for the next task, eventually waiting for the first task again, while this one here is waiting, obviously, for process 2. This is waiting for process 2. This one is waiting for process 3, requesting that one, which is held by that one. So I have a dependency chain here, but it's not closed. I don't have the circular dependency. The moment process 3 would wait for process 1 by, for example, applying here, then I have a circular wait and I have a potential deadlock situation. In fact, I have now two circular dependency chains. I have a circular dependency as we already constructed. Process 1 waits for process 2, waits for process 3, waits for process 1. But I also have a circular dependency. Process 2 waits for process 3, waits also for process 2. So I have two circular dependencies here. And this one could be deadlocked. Is it deadlocked? You sure? It is deadlocked, and I can derive something more. I do know that if I have deadlocks in my system, I will see these circular dependencies. Okay. How do I automate that? How could I actually do that? Basically by constructing the circular dependencies, which is often referred to as edge chasing. You are sending probes around between all of these processes, or the operating system is collecting that and trying to detect whether you find circular dependencies. If you do this in a distributed system, there is a lot of message passing involved, obviously, because you have to check with other laptops, with other computers on the planet, whether they are involved in the chain or not. And to do this efficiently, there's a whole body of literature around that one, which I think you refer to on the website as well. So just a little bit think about how you would implement this detection mechanism to detect a circular dependency. The moment the process receives its own probe, then it means there must have been a circular chain there. You're just sending a message to the process you're waiting for, always in the chain right in front of you. You get your own message back. Terrible. I'm actually involved in a circular waiting situation here. The other way around, if I know ahead of time that process 3 may claim this one or may claim this one, then I could do this possibly a bit more strategically, so that in the actual event, I assign it in a way so that things will not get into a circular wait situation. I know that process 2 is requesting resource 3 at the moment, and process 3 will request that potentially as well, or already start requesting that. So I have these two conflicting requests here. What I can do with that is I do assign the resources now cleverly, namely I do assign resource 3 to process 2. That means, why would I do that? Give me an algorithmic argument or something you can implement algorithmically to make that decision. What do you want to optimize? Yeah, we are getting to that. You want to optimize processes terminating, processes having all resources they need. So the preference is always, if you have a choice to give resources to specific tasks, give it to those tasks which then can terminate and complete. Now, in this case, it's a single step operation, so that's easy. But if it's going over multiple resources, you need to look ahead a little bit. Is there a chain of resource allocations available to me so that I can allow a specific process to terminate? If I can do that, assign the resources along those paths. Then this process terminates and I'm okay. Because that's out of the game and cannot form part of a circular dependency anymore. Okay? So I can avoid that. What can we now derive from that one? We already know that if processes are deadlocked, we will see circles in the resource allocation graph. Okay. If we have circles, then resources are potentially deadlocked. That's the rule which I can derive for resources with multiple instances. But I have something stronger. If I have only resources which have single instances, in this specific case, I do know that they actually are deadlocked because there is no way out. What's the difference? Let me illustrate this again by example. This is an actual deadlock situation. We identified that one. So we have circulars, could be a deadlock. It is actually a deadlock. If I have multiple instances, could be a deadlock again, applying the rule which we had before, and it is actually a deadlock. So it could very well be a deadlock, and it is in that case. Why is there a possibility how for multiple instances this deadlock may not be the case? Like that. So if I have now again circular dependencies, process 1 on process 2, process 2 on process 3, waits for process 1. Nice circular dependency, another circular chain here. So I have the circular dependency, but it is not deadlocked because we have multiple instances of resource 2, and one of these instances is held by a process which is uninvolved in the circular wait, which means this is actually not a deadlock situation. Process 4 is now releasing this resource, and process 3 can now gain access to that one, which means process 3 can complete and the whole chain disappears. Everybody can terminate. Okay? So, if I have now multiple instances, I need more complex algorithms to actually do that. So I need to find now an answer. How can I detect actual deadlocks in the general case? Now, if you're already frustrated at this point about detecting deadlocks, looks messy, complicated, and CPU intensive. Yes, it does. And you're tending back to, give me back my deadlock prevention. I want to have a system which cannot possibly deadlock. I want to get out of this mess. You're probably right. And this should still always be in the back of your head. This should be your professional reflex. If you can design systems which cannot deadlock, you will always do that. It means you do not have any runtime overhead. You do not need to detect anything. You don't have to waste your brain cells on finding, detecting, and writing correct deadlock detection algorithms and then finding a way of avoiding them and getting around that. If your system cannot possibly deadlock, that's the classical outcome which you want to achieve in your systems. Most, not all, but most high integrity systems are exactly designed like that. Again, if you have a flight simulator, if you have a flight controller, you will definitely not have a deadlock detection algorithms in there. You will have a flight controller which cannot possibly deadlock no matter how you program. And that structural difference is what you should be striving for. Good. That brings me to the conclusion for this lecture here. Do we allow preemption in case where deadlock is detection? How else can we get out of the deadlock? Now, the strategy will be a little different. It's a very good question. So detecting a deadlock, usually you have to admit defeat at this point already. It's too late. But you can use these algorithms to detect the potential for deadlock just one step ahead. And that's the actual useful strategy. If you actually go to the extra effort of detecting deadlocks, potential deadlocks in your system, then you know that by assigning resources in a specific clever way, you can avoid the deadlock to happen at all. And your system is safe if you go in a specific direction. This is the strategy. Detecting deadlocks is always a bit of a shotgun situation. It will be messy no matter what. There is no easy, smooth way out of it. If your system is deadlocked, somebody will be bleeding. And nobody's liking to implement something like that. Talk to people in compiler, runtime environments, operating systems, how much they like to kill processes. It is really terrible getting all of that out of that clean, releasing all of the resources in a clean way. It's not something that you would like to do in a deadlock situation. Prevention is the best cure. Exactly. Is that a medical slogan? Prevention is the best cure. Anyway. So, is there cases where deadlock prevention is impossible? If you cannot violate any of the four deadlock conditions, yes. So for some reason, for example, ordering of resources is impossible for some reason because, for example, your resources are dynamic and you don't know all of your resources at any given time. Any of your clients can bring in new resources dynamically while runtime of the system. It'll be very hard to actually order resources here and to prevent circular waiting situations. So there will be cases like that. My answer would be, in most cases, you will be able to apply deadlock prevention. And in the world which I live in, you can always do that because it's more integrity, high integrity and static environments where you can guarantee things like that. But if you work in a highly dynamic environment where everybody can bring in new objects and derive new children every time, all the time, in your object hierarchy, new messages, new resources at all times, that can lead to a more messy situation where sometimes you can't. Okay, good. I think that should conclude most of that. Your second assignment. That's probably your next step, which you will be looking at after the lecture now. Just download the framework, knock yourself out there. Your second assignment is really nice and beautiful in terms of what you need to get your head around and how much code you have to produce, namely very little. And you have to get your head around a very core concept of distributed message passing. Trying to avoid that your whole system is locking up. This is something that you will be confronted with very quickly. How do you avoid that? How do you make sure that all of your tasks are staying active, live and kicking, and all your routers will be working to maximum efficiency and the smallest amount of CPU consumption will be your second assignment. And it's physically fairly convincing. If you can do this in this synchronous message passing framework, this is pretty close to what you would find in an actual router. And I hope your routers are actually better than a lot of routers which you can buy off the shelf from your local hardware store. A lot of these router algorithms are actually fairly buggy and they're memory leaking like mad. And a lot of these routers are actually crashing after a month because they have some memory leaks which they couldn't get rid of. Your system should be more reliable than that. Goodie. Keep me posted. Don't forget to go to your labs. As I said, your labs are very friendly and open at the moment, backfilling everything which you want to catch up on. And let me know how everything else goes. Your first assignment is well in the marking at the moment. We are striving at handing back the marks by end of next week. Looks also pretty good, what you have submitted from what we have seen so far. So that looks all nice. So I'm pretty happy with the overall performance in the course at the moment. Goodie. Have a great weekend and see you on Monday. Cheers. Thanks.